The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. I'm going to cover a number of topics and issues in this broadcast, but first I want to focus on the recent so-called debate of leading Republican candidates for the presidency that was held on November 22nd in Washington, D.C., and broadcast across the country. Because what these candidates said and what they indicated about how their policies would be as presidency says a lot about the character and quality not only of these candidates, but something about the nature of American political life today. It's astonishing that men of this intelligence level and this character are even being considered as candidates for the presidency of the United States. The overwhelming impression that people around the world and thoughtful people here in the United States have is of candidates who are pandering, who are ignorant, and who are arrogant. The one exception among the Republican leaders who presented themselves at this debate was Ron Paul. Now, one can disagree with Ron Paul about this or that issue, but he is a principled and consistent man, unlike the other candidates at this debate. Now, this isn't an endorsement necessarily of Ron Paul. There are things about his views that I don't entirely agree with. But he stood out in the debate as having more common sense and devotion to principle than any of the others. The two leading candidates for the presidency right now are Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney. Now, these polls, which score who's ahead and who's behind in the Republican nomination, have been very volatile, very fluid. And somebody might be ahead this week who will be down the next week. But as of today, the leading candidates supposedly are Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney. Well, both candidates say things and have taken positions so difficult to support that it's amazing that they are the leading candidates of the Republican Party for the presidency. First, Newt Gingrich. Well, it's remarkable that a party that prides itself even more than the Democratic Party as a party of virtue and of ethics, that Newt Gingrich should even be in the running, that he should have any kind of popular support. Nearly 15 years ago, Newt Gingrich was the Speaker of the House of Representatives. He's representing a district in the state of Georgia. Newt Gingrich's ethical standards came under such scrutiny and such criticism that he was condemned by the House of Representatives in an unprecedented rebuke that for the first time in the 208-year history of the House of Representatives, congressmen voted overwhelmingly to reprimand Newt Gingrich for ethical wrongdoing and ordered him to pay an unprecedented $300,000 penalty. Now, Newt Gingrich is an intelligent man. He's obviously smart. He has a doctoral degree. But he's so slippery, so unethical, that it's astonishing that he can even be in the running for the presidency of the United States and could be considered as a leading candidate for the presidency. Now, in this debate, he made a statement that, although we all misspeak from time to time, but this is especially astonishing coming from a man who says he has a doctoral degree in history. He said this: "There's a core thing that is wrong with this whole city," he said, talking about Washington, D.C. And again, this is typical of Newt Gingrich, who tries to portray himself as really different than other politicians in Washington, when in fact he's as much a pillar of the Washington establishment, or has been, as any of the candidates of either party. He said, "There's something wrong with this whole city. You said earlier," referring to someone else, "that it would take too long to open up American oil. We defeated Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and Imperial Japan in 3 years and 8 months because we thought we were serious," he said. Well, this is an example of the kind of pandering ignorance that might go down well with a lot of his audience, but which is just factually untrue. To say that the United States defeated Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and Imperial Japan in 3 months and 3 years and 8 months is a misrepresentation, a gross misrepresentation of the reality of World War II. Of those three countries, the most important militarily was, of course, Germany. It was more important militarily by far than Italy or Japan. But Germany in World War II was defeated overwhelmingly, not by the United States, but by the Soviet Union, a country that Newt Gingrich and most Republicans are rather shamefaced in, if they even want to mention that that at one time the United States and the Soviet Union were very important military allies. But in World War II, four-fifths of Germany's military divisions were destroyed and defeated on the Eastern Front by the Soviet Union, not by the United States. The decisive turning points in World War II came in the winter of 1941-1942, when German forces were unable to take Moscow, and then with the defeat of German forces, the German Sixth Army, along with Romanian and Hungarian divisions in the Battle of Stalingrad in the winter of 1942-1943. And this enormous defeat of German forces along the Volga River. And then in the summer of 1943, Germany launched its last major offensive on the Eastern Front. It was in the area of Kursk in Russia. And this was the largest tank battle in history. And it was a defeat for the Germans. It was a major offensive, but the Soviet forces were larger, much superior in numbers, and they were able to stop the German advance. From the summer of 1943 to the end of the war, Germany was unable to launch any serious major offensive on the Eastern Front. And the United States didn't even play a decisive role until later on. It wasn't until the summer of 1944, when the tide of battle had turned decisively against Germany, that the United States even landed troops in the famous D-Day invasion of northern France in June of 1944. But by the time American forces landed, the battle had already been decided on the Eastern Front. In fact, if American forces and British forces had tried to land in Normandy in 1941 or 42, or even 1943, almost certainly they would have been destroyed and turned back and driven from the sea. But because they landed in the summer of 1944, less than a year before the end of the war and after the tide of battle had been turned decisively, Only then was this landing able to be successful. But Newt Gingrich, who says he has a doctoral degree in history, for him to claim that the United States defeated Nazi Germany and fascist Italy and Japan is a gross misrepresentation of historical reality. But it's typical of the kind of slipshod way that American politicians in general talk about history. Now, I don't want to focus on Newt Gingrich, because there was a lot of stupidity and arrogance and pandering by other candidates in this November 22nd debate as well. A good example is that of Herman Cain. There was a commentary in a major British newspaper just the other week by a commentator making the point that Herman Cain is so ignorant, so simplistic, that it's an astonishing thing that he's even seriously considered as any kind of candidate for any important office in the United States, much less presidency of this country, and that it's a shameful thing that he's gotten the kind of attention and support, level of support, that he already has in America. During the November 22nd debate, Herman Cain made this statement, quote, "I would work with our allies in the region," he's referring to the Middle East, to put pressure to be able to try and get our allies and other nations to stop buying oil from Syria. That would be one thing I would do, but I would not support a no-fly zone. Well, the question was about Syria, so it's very hard to imagine that Herman Cain had Syria, in this case, confused with some other country. But the fact is, the United States, nobody imports oil, buys oil from Syria, because Syria doesn't produce any oil. Now, Herman Cain may not know that. He may have simply assumed that if it's an Arab country or a Middle Eastern country, it has oil. But Syria is not Saudi Arabia, it's not Iran, it's not Iraq. Syria has to import oil. Syria is not a country that exports oil. But this kind of ignorance on the part of Herman Cain is simply typical of the gaffes and the ignorance that this man has shown in other areas as well. Now, another thing that came up a number of times in this debate and in other speeches and debates by Republican candidates is a kind of self-satisfied view of America as a especially virtuous and righteous country in a way that no other country in the world is. And this was manifest and expressed in this debate as well. Candidate Rick Santorum explicitly said, "It's important for us to use all the assets we have, promote our values. America is that shining city on the hill," he said. And Mitt Romney in the debate said, "I believe America is an exceptional and unique nation." He said that unlike Barack Obama, who thinks that the United States has to operate in the world where other countries have interests and other countries might have power, he thinks that American military superiority is the right course, and that there are lots of evil people in the world, and that instead of a multipolar balancing world, that America should be by far the number one military power in the world, because America is an exceptional and unique nation. Well, of course, every nation in the world is unique in one way or the other, and American history is an unusual one. But what Mitt Romney and many others mean when they talk about America as an exceptional nation is this notion that America is more righteous, is better than any other country in the world. And this is not only arrogant and laughable and childish, but it's especially stupid at a time when America faces and has to deal now with tremendous problems here that are really overwhelming. And to talk about America being exceptional, being the shining city on the hill, this kind of rhetoric is a substitute for the real straightforward and honest grappling with issues, which is crucial at this time, but is intended as a substitute for that by pandering to the the feelings of self-satisfaction that many Americans want to hear it during this time. Another feature of this debate, and it's true of many other debates and speeches by especially Republican leaders, but also by Democratic leaders, is the stress on America's unswerving, total commitment to the interests and security of Israel. In fact, during this debate, and this comes up time and again, the one country that Republican leaders and Democratic leaders stress that the United States has a firm commitment to and support for is Israel. In this debate, John Huntsman even said, "Our interest in the Middle East is Israel, and our interest is to ensure that Israel, that Iran does not go nuclear." Now, this is astonishing. "Our interest in the Middle East is Israel," said John Huntsman. Well, United States' relationship with Israel is one that, on balance, is harmful to the United States. The United States gives more military aid, more aid, every year to Israel than to any other single country. Over the years, the United States has given many billions of dollars to Israel. Israel doesn't provide oil. It doesn't provide any essential services to the United States. It's a net drain on the interests of the United States. But Huntsman, Romney, Michelle Bachmann, these other candidates who express their unswerving support for Israel are doing this not because they really care about Israel, or even America for that matter, but because they want to get elected. And to get elected in our country, they have to pander to those who have power in our country. And there is no single ethnic religious group in America that has more power than the organized Jewish community in America. What they're really supporting isn't Israel. They're supporting themselves by pandering to the organized Jewish community in America, to the Jewish-Israel lobby in this country. And that's why in this debate, two of the candidates said openly during this debate that if they're, as president of the United States, the first foreign trip they will make will be to Israel. Mitt Romney said, quote, "If I'm president of the United States, my first foreign trip will be to Israel." One commentator, a British commentator, said this was reaching a new high in American political Israel love, because these candidates, as the rest of the world knows, fall over each other to outdo each other in their expressions of love and support for Israel. And what they're really doing, of course, as I say, is pandering to the organized Jewish community. Mitt Romney said, "And the right course for Israel is to show that we care about Israel, that they are our friend, we'll stick with them. If I'm president of the United States, my first foreign trip will be to Israel to show the world that we care about that country and that region." That's Mitt Romney. In fact, Mitt Romney is so beholden to Israel and so out of touch with the real needs of America that he has, in a very highly publicized formal statement, announced that as president, he will increase American military spending, which is already, both in absolute and relative terms, the greatest it's ever been in history, even during the period of the Cold War. And larger by far. Well, U.S. military today is, by most commentators, as large as the military spending of the rest of the world put together. And the idea that America needs to have even more military spending at a time when America is essentially broke is just madness. And for Mitt Romney and for other Republican candidates, the number one country they care about in the world and want to use this military to protect and defend is not Britain or Canada or other countries that the United States has authentic, real interests with, but Israel, a country that the alliance of which for the United States is a source ultimately of weakness, not a source of strength. For John Huntsman to say that our interest in the Middle East is Israel is revealing, because the new U.S. ambassador to Israel even explicitly stated recently that the motive and reason for U.S. policy in the Middle East is first and foremost focused on the securing Israel's interests. Well, this is astonishing, because it means that American foreign policy is determined, in that region at least, not by what's good for America and humanity, but rather what's good for Israel. Our foreign policy is driven not by the authentic interests of our people or of the world, but rather by the power that's wielded by the organized Jewish community in this country. Again, in the debate, a good example, again, another good example of the kind of ignorance in that forum, was a statement by Rick Perry. He said, "Until Pakistan clearly shows that they have America's best interests in mind, I would not send them one penny, period." Well, this is, again, astonishing. No country in the world, Pakistan, Israel, Britain, France, any country, is going to have a leadership that shows clearly, as he puts it, that they have America's best interests in mind. They would be traitors if they did that. Rick Perry, in effect, is asking the leaders of Pakistan to be more loyal to the United States than they are to their own country. For him to say, until Pakistan clearly shows that they have America's best interests in mind, is just astonishing. And the arrogance of it is underscored if one just keeps in mind imagining any foreigner saying that American leaders have to show that they have France's best interests in mind, or Mexico's best interests in mind, or any other country's. Such a demand or a call by any foreigner would be regarded by Americans, rightly, as unbelievable arrogance. But that's the way Rick Perry talks. Again, in his debate, he said, "I happen to think that Communist China is destined for the ash heap of history because they are not a country of virtues." Well, this again is just childish ignorance, stupidity, really. A country isn't destined for the ash heap of history because they are or are not a country of virtues, especially from the point of view of somebody like Rick Perry. A regime will rise or fall, not according to whether it's virtuous from his point of view, but whether its political, social system is sound, whether its population has character and quality, and its leadership has a realistic sense of itself and its place in the world. But if being virtuous is essential, well then, this country, by those standards, ought to be headed for the ash heap of history, because it's been carrying out policies that, by the very standards America has tried to enforce in the world, are immoral. Most obviously, America has been carrying out illegal wars, wars of aggression, wars that are carried out for reasons not having to do with defense. By the standards that Americans imposed against other countries, notably, for example, against Germany in the Nuremberg trials, when German leaders were shot or hanged, America has been carrying out actions that would have merited the death penalty for American leaders if we had imposed, if we held ourselves to those same standards. Most older Americans today can hardly believe that we live in a time in which American leaders now openly acknowledge that this country condones and supports torture. Now, the United States has carried out torture for a long time, but in the past it did so secretly or surreptitiously. It was ashamed of it. And now the United States does that openly. That's the kind of behavior that we used to condemn when carried out by other countries. So, but Communist China will do what it does, and it'll do well, regardless of whether Rick Perry thinks it's virtuous or not. But this is a fallacious way of looking at history and at the world. Well, we'll take a break at this point and resume in a few moments with the second half of this broadcast.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
So as Eurozone leaders scramble to solve the debt crisis that some officials, as I said, say they have 10 days left to figure out, finance ministers have been meeting and they agreed to ramp up firepower of the European Bailout Fund. This is known as the EFSF. But they said they may have to turn to the IMF for more help. Now, also coming out of that meeting, reportedly Italy is at risk of insolvency. Meanwhile, businesses, they're coming up with contingency plans for a possible end of the euro. That's according to the Financial Times. And enter the central banks with their fire hose of dollars to try to put out the fire for now, they hope. The Federal Reserve, the central banks of Canada, England, Japan, the Swiss National Bank, and the European central banks have joined forces to essentially bail out the euro for now. Markets look pretty happy about it today. As for what the central banks are doing, they are lowering dollar swap rates. Now, this gives European banks cheap emergency access to dollars. But what is firing off rounds of cheap money do for the global currency war that my next guest argues we are in? Well, let's find out, because we have Jim Rickards in the studio with us. If you haven't read his book, I recommend you go out and buy it and do it now. It's right there. It's Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis. And he's here in studio. We are so glad to have you. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Lawrence. Nice to be here.
Great. Well, let's just get right to this.
Sure.
So what do you think? In your view, is this the Federal Reserve bailing out the euro?
Well, what they're saying is this is a masterpiece of sort of perception over reality. What they're saying is they'll do whatever it takes. In substance, this wasn't that big a deal. The swap lines have been in place for years. They do have to get renewed periodically. They can be increased periodically. There are offsetting rates. So what the Fed did is we're going to make it a little bigger, we're going to make it a little cheaper. But it was more the signal. It said, look, clearly Europe's in distress. Clearly there's a run on the bank in terms of dollars. And the Fed said, we're going to do whatever it takes. So the substance of it was fairly small, but the message was huge, which is we'll do this, we'll do more, we'll increase them if we have to, we'll do whatever it takes. And that's why the markets were relieved, and that's why stocks went up. I mean, the stock market loves free money.
Yeah, they do love that easy money. But you said something about a run on banks.
Yeah.
And it's funny because there were some rumors and some speculation in a Forbes article.
Sure.
That, hey, was a big European bank, you know, not able to get money last night? Is that why we're seeing this decision from the Fed today? Do you think that there is kind of this quiet run on banks going on that the Federal Reserve and other central banks are trying to do anything to avoid?
Well, yes, it's actually been going on since last summer. It was quiet, it was behind the scenes. It's not in anyone's interest to talk about it. It was slow, but what's happened recently is the tempo has picked up, and you see, Deutsche Bank is almost like a central bank unto itself. In other words, the European banks are afraid to lend to each other, but they will lend to Deutsche Bank because that's considered to be the strongest private bank in Europe, and then Deutsche Bank can selectively re-lend.
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Hello and welcome back. I was commenting on some of the remarks made at the November 22nd debate, or so-called debate, of leading Republican candidates for the presidency. And I was mentioning especially this remark recently when we went on break, the remark by Rick Perry about his statement that I happen to think that Communist China is destined for the ash heap of history because they are not a country of virtues. Well, this is just astonishing. And in that regard, he mentions that communist China has a policy of condoning or even requiring abortions in many cases. Well, countries don't live or die because they are, quote, virtuous in that sense. If that was true, a foreigner might easily have said that the United States was doomed to the ash heap of history when it was founded, because it was a country that condoned and carried out, had slavery. Well, today we regard slavery as a unmitigated evil, but for the first 80 years of American history, slavery was part of the customs and law of this country. And China will, the record between the United States and China in the last 10, 15 years has been one that, for Rick Perry to think they're doomed to ash heap of history is just is silliness. Finally, there was a remark made during the debate by Mitt Romney that, again, is an expression of just unbelievable arrogance. He said, "We need to bring Pakistan into the 21st century, or the 20th century, for that matter, so that they can engage throughout the world with trade and with modernity," unquote. Well, it's talk like this that around the world makes America regarded as a country of just ignorance and arrogance. "We need to bring Pakistan into the 21st century," Romney says. Well, who appointed Romney or the United States to bring anybody into any century? What Pakistan does or what any country does is up to them. What kind of social political system or the standards they have is going to be up to them. And nobody appointed Mitt Romney or the United States of America to do the bringing of Pakistan or any other country into any century. Especially this kind of talk is stupid and arrogant at a time when more and more Americans are living in want, in poverty, and when American cities are in the shape that they are, and America has the enormous problems that we have to contend with. For Mitt Romney or for anybody to be talking about how the United States is going to be changing or transforming other places is not only arrogant, but at this point in American history, stupid. Now, an amazing contrast to the arrogance and the wishful thinking, the pandering of the candidates at this recent Republican debate was a remark made by a former U.S. Senator, Mike Gravel, who at one time was also a presidential candidate. Mike Gravel was a U.S. Senator from Alaska. In a recent interview, he spoke very forcefully about how shamefully the United States has been acting in recent years. He compared the United States to an immoral drunkard who's charging into war. He said, "I like the U.S., but at the same time I think my country is an imperial country that is going downhill, and our leadership does not even acknowledge the problem. Phony triumphalism has turned into a device to make Americans live in fear of a terrorist attack." He says, "All I can say about what the U.S. is doing, it's immoral," he said. And he mentioned the Afghanistan war, the Iraq war, and he mentioned also the Vietnam war, wars in which, he said, American soldiers have died in vain. Well, those are harsh words, but they're a lot more realistic than the rightly termed phony triumphalism of the Republican candidates, with the exception of Ron Paul, in this recent debate, and the kind of arrogant rhetoric that also comes from the White House and the president and the presidency of Barack Obama. But America is increasingly perceived all over the world as a country of arrogance, a country that is acting in an immoral way around the world, that has one standard for the rest of the world and another standard for America. And the proof of this is the lack of any kind of consideration about what we've done in the past. America insists that foreign countries be continually atoning for the alleged misdeeds of their past, notably Poles, Germans, Hungarians, the Vatican, the Swiss, and so forth, are to be over and over reminded and forced to atone for the Holocaust. But there is so little self-reflection in this country for what these our leaders do. It's pretty generally acknowledged now, even by the most fervent flag-waving American, that the U.S. invasion, occupation, bombing of Iraq was carried out and supported on the basis of deceit, of false claims made to the American public and the world. But there's been absolutely no accountability for this for the tremendous suffering, destruction that was brought on by the bombing, invasion, and occupation of Iran by American forces under President George W. Bush. Neither George W. Bush, nor Dick Cheney, nor Wolfowitz, nor Rumsfeld have ever been called to account for what they did. The closest example of closest expression of kind of a contrition for his role was by Colin Powell, who said that his presentation at the United Nations shortly before the U.S. invasion was the most shameful incident in his life. But the criticisms by Mike Gravel and by others of U.S. policy often, however, overlook that this pattern of arrogance, this pattern of double standard, did not start with the Vietnam War and certainly didn't start with the Iraq and Afghanistan War and is not something new in American life. This has been true for many, many years. And as I've stressed on a number of broadcasts and in numerous writings, the U.S. record during World War II is one of a tremendous arrogance and double standard, in which policies carried out by the United States were considered great and wonderful by the American leaders and supported by the American public, but which, when anything like that is carried out by other countries, the United States would condemn. Now, this is all part of the emphasis in recent years on this so-called American exceptionalism, this notion that America is a better country, and the underlying notion that Rick Perry touched on, that America has done well because it's virtuous. This is very, very dangerous thinking. It's childish, really. It's not only incorrect. At our time in American life, it's especially dangerous. America has been a very successful country for much of its history, especially from about 1870 to 1970. For about 100 years, America was extraordinarily prosperous and dynamic. But this isn't because Americans were more virtuous. There's a notion among many Americans that good guys succeed and bad guys fail. That in international affairs, good countries, good people win wars and are successful, and bad people lose wars. And that good people are prosperous and financially, economically successful, and bad people are not. Well, that's just simply silliness. I came to understand that vividly when I lived in Europe as a young man. virtually every European country at one time or another has lost wars. They've been defeated. They've been occupied. They've had bombs fall on their cities. And they know that a country, no matter how righteous or how prosperous it might be, can also be defeated. And they have there's a much greater sense in much of the world about history and about the having more consistent standards than there is in this country, because America has been a very fortunate nation, a nation that has not had to suffer in the way that many other societies have over the years. But this notion of, well, America was very successful for much of its history because it was settled by ambitious and capable people from Europe who were able to grab hold of an entire continent with very little effort. The only people living were the native Indians who lived on a very primitive level. They didn't have manufacturing, they didn't have written languages, and people from Europe were able to take America with very little effort and with no competition, and to exploit resources ruthlessly. That's why pioneers who came to the United States from Europe were able to exhaust soil and then just move on westward, cut down forests and move on, kill the buffalo and move on. Now, the tremendous dynamism of American life from the beginning of the settlement of Europeans in this continent up until 1900 or 1880 was possible because the country was still very open, and it could be exploited with very little regard for the long-term consequences. But that isn't because Americans were virtuous. It was the enormous fortune, good fortune, of being able to take hold of a continent with almost no effort. America also benefited tremendously from the fact that after World War II, it emerged in the world as the one industrial power that had not been destroyed in the war. Europe had been ruined, completely destroyed. Russia destroyed. Japan was destroyed. China had been occupied and engaged in, had been plagued by war and then by civil war afterwards. And so America emerged from World War II as the undisputed, unquestionably the most powerful financially, economically, industrially important paramount country in the world. Now that's changed since about the 1970s and 80s. The rest of the world has built up now, and America's place in the world is not what it was. Now that's not because America is less virtuous or more virtuous or whatever. These are objective factors that have changed over this period of time. Now the myth of American exceptionalism holds that America's wars have basically always been good wars, because it's a kind of slogan in America: American soldiers fight for freedom. We represent the good. And a corollary of this, then, is that America's wars have never been mistakes. That's another way of saying that our political leaders have never blundered in going to war, because they've all been wars for freedom. They've been wars for good. To take any other view, to think that American wars might have been mistakes, is almost to force a reconsideration of American history and our very identity as a country. One person who has written very critically of U.S. foreign policy in the 20th century is a former U.S. President, Herbert Hoover. Before he died, he worked on a book about what he considered major blunders of U.S. Statesmanship and policy. And Herbert Hoover has been unjustly criticized for for ushering in the Great Depression that began in the October or November of 1929, just months after he'd been elected president. But it's unfair because Herbert Hoover obviously was not responsible for that. He just happened to be the president at the time. But human nature being what it is, he was held accountable for all of that because he was unable to get out of the Depression and people turned against him. But Herbert Hoover was an extraordinarily savvy, experienced man who had lived in many different countries, had met with people in many different cultures, and had a familiarity with the world that vastly transcends the and makes the ignorance of men like Romney, Michelle Bachmann, Huntsman, Rick Perry, and so forth. In this book that he was writing, which is now being published many years after his death, he criticized very strongly big blunders in U.S. and world policy. He said one of them, he said, was an abysmal loss of statesmanship when Britain and France guaranteed the independence of Poland and Romania at the end of 1939 and went to war against Germany over the Danzig Corridor Polish issue. This was not only wrong but stupid because Britain and France were unable to make good on their pledges. They were helpless to save Poland from invasion anyway, and this made inevitable not only a war, but a war of continental scope that brought huge destruction for the peoples of Europe, and then, of course, widened into the war involving the Soviet Union and the United States. Herbert Hoover also criticizes a major blunder of statesmanship of President Franklin Roosevelt in 1941, when the United States, at that time supposedly a neutral country, nonetheless waged an undeclared war against Germany and Japan, as Hoover points out, in total violation of promises that he had made as a politician running for the presidency during the presidential election campaign in 1940, and also, of course, in total, complete violation of international law and even of American law, that is, a violation of his oath as President of the United States. In order to do so, President Roosevelt lied to the American public, deceived the American public, broke international law. But for Republican leaders today, and for many Americans, Franklin Roosevelt is considered a great man and an example of the very kind of virtue that they say America is supposed to represent. He also says that the greatest loss, Hoover says, the greatest loss of statesmanship in all American history. Now consider that. In all American history, Hoover says, the greatest loss of statesmanship was the tacit American alliance and support of communist Russia in the summer of 1941 after Germany and its allies attacked the Soviet Union. Germany and its allies, Finland, Romania, Hungary, and so forth, attacked the USSR on June 22, 1941. And the United States could have stayed out of that conflict. But immediately, President Roosevelt dispatched his colleague, Harry Hopkins, to Moscow to assure Stalin of American support. And immediately, the American government began doing everything it could to provide military and economic assistance to the Soviet Union when it was threatened with annihilation by Germany and its allies. And for Herbert Hoover, and I think for many others too, this was the greatest catastrophe, the greatest failure of American statesmanship during the 20th century. In fact, the most important ally of Soviet communism ever in the history of the Soviet Union was the United States from 1941 to 1945. Without America's help and the help of Britain, almost certainly the Soviet Union would have been eradicated as a communist state by Germany and its allies during that time. And this goes to the core, I think, of the larger sense of self-identification, of self-identity that Americans have about their history. It's an emphasis not on who we are, but on our supposed virtue. Now, virtue, of course, is a good thing, but it's no substitute for character and identity. And for many Americans, especially those who call themselves patriotic or conservative, there is an emphasis on so-called virtue, which in our world today is little more than just self-righteousness and increasingly is just simply arrogant. It's a way of justifying whatever we're doing. And at the center of all of this is our view of the most important military conflict in world history and the American role in it, that is, of World War II. And that's one of the reasons why myself and the IHR stress over and over the importance of a sober, realistic, fact-based understanding of World War II, this most important of conflicts, because without it, a firm and sober, realistic sense of who we are as a country and our place in the world is impossible. I put it this way sometimes, that you can tell a person's basic attitude about ourselves as a country and our social political outlook by asking what they think of Franklin Roosevelt and the American role in World War II. For those people who say that World War II was the good war, that America was righteous in that conflict, is another way of abandoning or rejecting any kind of objective standard of American conduct, because in that conflict, the United States aligned itself with the British Empire on the one hand, the most imperialistic power in the world at the time, and with the Soviet Union, the unquestionably the most tyrannical regime in the world at that time. And to call America's role in World War II righteous, or to call America's role in the war the good war for that reason, is to make a mockery of what those virtues mean or should mean. Well, during these broadcasts, I've been very gratified by the many helpful comments and suggestions that listeners have made. And I want to encourage listeners to these broadcasts to continue to write to me and phone with suggestions and comments, which have been very useful in focusing my own thinking and in making the broadcasts, I think, and I hope, better for the future.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time, only on VOR, Reason Radio Network.com.